This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Murdering Mumia, Part 2, The Anatomy of a Frame-Up. December 9th, 1981. Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner is shot and murdered in the 1200 block of Locust Street after a traffic stop. Mumia Abu-Jamal, noted journalist, radio journalist, and president of the Philadelphia Journalists Association, is wounded in the chest and arrested with a revolver at his feet. A jury deliberated for 3 hours on July 2, 1982, before convicting Abu-Jamal for first-degree murder. It was a setup. It was a frame-up. And to begin that frame-up, you have to look at who was appointed the judge in the case. Philadelphia's king of death row, Albert Szabo. As Amnesty International reported, Albert Szabo was an undersheriff of Philadelphia County for 16 years before becoming a judge in 1974. His official biography lists him as a former member of the National Sheriff's Association, retired Fraternal Order of Police, and as associated with the Police Chiefs Association of Southeast Pennsylvania. As a judge, he was no stranger to the death penalty. Over a period of 14 years, he presided over trials in which 31 defendants were sentenced to death, more than any other U.S. judge, as far as Amnesty International is aware. Of the 31 condemned defendants, 29 came from ethnic minorities. 29 came from ethnic minorities. Here we have Judge Albert Szabo as the judge in the case and also as the judge in the reconsideration, the PRCA, hearing later. Judge Albert Szabo sentenced Mumia Abu-Jamal to death. The defendant denounced the trial as a farce and a sham. He was outside the trial for most of it, banned from the proceedings by Judge Szabo himself. Mumia Abu-Jamal, known as the voice of the voiceless, has continued as a journalist throughout his years on death row. There have been international campaigns and many proceedings to free Abu-Jamal. The Pew Center for Research noted that in the year 2008, 2,319,258 people were in U.S. prisons and jails. That is, 1 out of 100 American adults are in prison today. If you are an African American male between the ages of 25 and 29, the chance that you will be incarcerated rises to 1 in 10. 10.4% of the African-American male population aged 25 to 29 is incarcerated. If you are a political activist, if you are the voice of the voiceless, as is Mumia Abu-Jamal, now and then, you will find the probability of incarceration, you will find the probability of being led to death row even higher. Today, on Taking Aim, we continue our conversation with Chris Kinder, coordinator of the Labor Action Committee to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Our discussion, The Anatomy of a Frame-Up. Ralph?
Yes, Maya. Chris Kinder has played a decisive and seminal role in not only mobilizing the trade union and labor activist population around the issue of Mumia Abu-Jamal, but engaging with those who have made examinations of the evidence, of challenging their framing of the information, of finding the aspects of what they have elucidated as establishing not only the deliberate, preconceived frame-up of Mumia Abu-Jamal with respect to the death of police officer Daniel Faulkner, but with respect to a broader design of eliminating Mumia Abu-Jamal because of his role in exposing the inveterate corruption of the Police Department of Philadelphia, its racist murder campaign against the poor and the dispossessed, and notably the black community of Philadelphia and beyond. Those are the underlying issues that inform the question of Mumia Abu-Jamal, just as the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the person of J. Edgar Hoover had issued a memorandum stating that a charismatic black leader, a messiah for the black population, could not be allowed to surface in the United States, that it was the task of the FBI to eliminate any such prospect and to nip it in the bud by executive action. This is a murder call. This is a death squad operation. This is the Justice Department and the Federal Bureau of Investigation on board Mumia Abu-Jamal's framing and the deliberate attempt to kill him in the process of targeting a cop who was cooperating with the feds, because the Federal Bureau of Investigation officer, Hersing, corroborated the fact that Faulkner was collaborating with the FBI with respect to corruption and mob activity of the cops in Philadelphia. All of this informs the basic fact that Mumia Abu-Jamal was a target for elimination, and in the process, the terrorizing of not just the black population, but of any potential resistance to this class war, this capitalist war upon the poor and the dispossessed, and above all, the disadvantaged in the cities, our black population. The war on black America is exemplified by the campaign to frame Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Chris, 20 witnesses came forth. They each saw different portions of the incident from different vantage points. And each of them described the situation differently. What did the prosecution do? How did the prosecution intimidate each and every one of these witnesses to come to trial and stage this frame-up?
Good day. It's good to be here again. Yes, I think it should be clear that all the prosecution witnesses that appeared in Mumia's case in 1982 in the trial have been discredited in one way or another. I'd like to begin by referring to Cynthia White, perhaps the most important witness in the case. Cynthia White was a prostitute who had many outstanding warrants and had been arrested many times and was well known to the police. She was near the scene but not on the scene. And when the police found that they needed to come up with a witness, the first witness actually that they interviewed was a man named William Singletary, who I'll get to in a moment. But William Singletary wanted to tell the truth, and he did not work out for them as a witness. So after they got rid of him, and they almost did literally get rid of him. They drove him out of town because they didn't like what he had to say about what he saw. They did scrounge around and came up with other witnesses. Cynthia White had been near the scene, and the police forced her by threatening to consolidate all of her cases and send her upstate, so to speak, meaning send her away for a long time to a state prison. They forced her to say that she had seen the shooting. She didn't say she had actually seen Mumia pull the trigger on the cop. Nobody actually said that. But Cynthia White was the only witness who said that she had seen Mumia with a gun in his hand. Now, we know that Cynthia White was lying because a confidant of her, someone that she sort of confessed to privately while she was in jail with this other person.
Yvette Williams.
That's right, Yvette Williams. She also did the same with Pamela Jenkins and another woman who appeared as a defense witness in Mumia's case, Veronica Jones, also knew something about what had happened. Veronica Jones said that she, Veronica, accepted the same deal that the other girl got, and that was a reference to Cynthia White. So what the police did was they brought Cynthia White in on various prostitution charges, and each time they did, they got a statement from her that was closer, became closer and closer to what they wanted her to say. Now, the prosecution scenario of the case was essentially that the officer, Daniel Faulkner, stopped Mumia's brother, who was a local street vending, a businessman working with a partner. They stopped his brother on the on Locust Street, the cop, Faulkner, was harassing and beating the brother, William Cook, with his flashlight. And the cops said that Mumia, who was driving a cab at the time and who was there to pick up possible passengers at the closing time of clubs in the area, this was a downtown central city area, saw his brother being beaten by this cop and ran to his defense and shot the cop once in the shoulder, and then stood over the cop, having the cop fell down to the pavement. They say that Mumia stood over Faulkner and fired several shots at him, one of which hit him between the eyes and killed him.
This is the prosecution.
This is the prosecution scenario, right. Mm-hmm. This is what they eventually got witnesses to attest to by using the kind of pressure tactics that I just described. They threatened Cynthia White with a consolidation of her cases, sending her upstate, and she said to this woman, Yvette Williams, that she was afraid for her life. She was afraid that her pimp might kill her for taking away his income. She was afraid of what the police would do to her. And she was also being rewarded for cooperating with the police. And according to Yvette Williams, Cynthia White was allowed to bring favors into the cell that no one else was allowed to get, certain, commercial items that weren't generally available, and perhaps even drugs, is, I think, what Yvette Williams said. But in any event, they terrified Cynthia White into concocting this tale. And other witnesses got similar treatment. The other witness that I'd like to go into at some length, who did not fall for this terror campaign by the police, was William Singletary. William Singletary was a local businessman who was on the scene to check up on activities in a competitor's club. Singletary said that he encountered Cynthia White on the scene before the incident happened, and that Cynthia White left the scene completely and only came back later after shots were fired. And several other witnesses said that they did not see Cynthia White on the scene. So, number one, Singletary, right off the bat, indicated what the truth was, that Cynthia White was to lie at the trial in 1982, Chris, and had never actually seen anything.
I just wanted to interject here, Chris, that what you're describing with respect to Cynthia White is the standard operating procedure of the Philadelphia police, and in particular with respect to this case. I think virtually every material witness who was brought into the police station was physically threatened, including with threats to their life. And it should be mentioned at this point that when Mumia Abu-Jamal, as a noted journalist, as president of the Black Journalists Association in Philadelphia, at a press conference, challenged Mayor Frank Rizzo about the pattern of police targeting of blacks, of framing of blacks, of murdering blacks, with specific information that he had developed.
That's right.
Rizzo, at a public press conference, looked at Mumia Abu-Jamal and said, I hope it happens while I am in office, he says, but we will get you. Something has to be done about you, and I assure you, while I'm in office, it's going to happen. An in-your-face physical threat to Mumia Abu-Jamal at a public event by Frank Rizzo, the mayor at the time, subject to the expose of this very pattern that we're describing in the current case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, that is the underlying politics and the reality of this murder of Mumia Abu-Jamal in preparation for which this case is but the little extension of the practices of the Philadelphia Police Department, of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and as we will explain further in this program, the Justice Department itself.
Yes.
Chris, could you also go into the testimony of Robert Chaubert, a 22-year-old cab driver who, it turns out, was driving illegally, and so the police had something on him, too.
Yes, the police had something on him. Apparently, he had thrown a Molotov cocktail into a schoolyard or something to that effect at some point. The police definitely had something on him.
And he had a suspended driver's license.
Right, he had a suspended driver's license. The police got him to say that he was parked in his cab right behind the officer's patrol car and that he saw the whole thing. And he later admitted to a defense investigator that he hadn't seen anything and had not, in fact, been parked within eyesight of the incident. He'd actually been around the corner. And that confession on the part of Chaubert was came sometime later. But even more recently, some photographs have turned up. The defense investigator, a German professor, Michael Schiffman, discovered some photographs that had been taken at right at the crime scene, right after the incident happened, by an independent operating photographer named Pedro Polakoff. And these photos were offered at the time to the police, and they were no response was given. The police weren't interested in what had actually happened. They were completely interested in making up their version of the story. But anyway, the Polakoff photos, very interestingly, show that there is no taxi cab parked behind Faulkner's patrol car. And as I said, these were taken right after the incident, even before official police photographers arrived on the scene.
And this is 26 photos. This isn't just a random one here,
that's
one
right
there. This is 26 photographs.
Several photographs. They were some of them were shown recently on a Today Show interview with Maureen Faulkner and a journalist from Philadelphia, and they were who were defending the police's case.
By the way, that journalist, Mirish McConish,
yes,
is not just some random journalist.
No.
He is a far-right racist journalist who uses his platform to utilize the most inflamed racist terminology with reference to the black population of Philadelphia and beyond. This is not just some journalist. This is a hitman for the cop culture of Philadelphia.
Yes.
I thought that in an article I saw, one of the most significant of the Polakoff photos is this. In court, police officer James Forbes claimed that he had, quote, secured the weapons of both Faulkner and Mumia without touching them on their metal parts in order not to destroy potential fingerprints. However, in the single photo that was reprinted in the book to which you referred, you can see that Forbes is touching the weapons on their metal parts, and that quite a few of Polakoff's other photos make it clear that Forbes not only touched, but that he smudged the weapons all over, destroying any potential fingerprint evidence that could have been on these weapons.
Yeah, actually, the photos weren't in the book that I referred to. The photos, however, can be viewed. Some of them can be viewed at abujamalnews.com. I believe it's .com. That's a website of journalists for Mumia. The photo that you referred to shows this cop, Forbes, apparently holding two weapons, two pistols in his hand with no gloves on and nothing keeping his fingers off the metal parts. And interestingly, again, the Polakoff photos show a lot of these things, but most of them have actually been revealed in other ways earlier by defense investigators in material that never found its way into court. So the Polakoff photos were a very graphic confirmation of a lot of evidence that has already come out before. For instance, William Singletary, the local businessman that I mentioned earlier, who had no reason to lie, he said that he pointed out the actual murder weapon, which was not Mumia's gun at all, but it had belonged to a guy named Kenneth Freeman, who got out of the passenger seat of William Cook's VW and fired at the officer and then fled the scene. And what Singletary said was that he, Singletary, pointed out the actual murder weapon, which had been tossed under the right wheel of the VW. He pointed it out to the cops who arrived on the scene. And he said they picked up the gun and passed it one to another, all of them touching it with their bare hands. And so the Polakoff photos caught part of that in one of the photos.
Well, Chris, just to clarify this for our listeners, William Singletary was one of those witnesses whose life was threatened by the police. And the threats were so overwhelming and constant that he finally fled for his life to North Carolina.
That's right.
But I want to emphasize that when William Singletary identifies Kenneth Freeman as the shooter, that has great significance because in the affidavit by Billy Cook, the brother of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was the driver of the vehicle at the scene. His passenger was his business associate and friend, Kenneth Freeman. And William Cook, Billy Cook, in his affidavit, confirms that Kenneth Freeman was there to shoot Daniel Faulkner because of Faulkner's cooperation with the feds in exposing the corruption of his fellow officers and, consequently, what Singletary was observing was the shooter who had been assigned by the police themselves to murder Faulkner as part of the elimination of the whistleblower cop who was going to corroborate what Mumia Abu-Jamal, amongst others, had established as the pattern of corruption and framing of victims by the Philadelphia Police Department. So right. The context here, the significance of Singletary corroborating with his own eyewitness testimony that the shooter is Kenneth Freeman, what he is doing by so saying is that he is an eyewitness to the police assassin in the process of the murder of Faulkner himself.
Or one of the assassins.
One of the assassins, yes, right. Because the backup is Beverly, as Arnold Beverly, as was established in his own confession.
Yeah, we should mention that the a person came forward much later in the 90s named Arnold Beverly, who claimed to have been a mob hitman, and he said he was paid to shoot and kill this Daniel Faulkner because, and I'm paraphrasing, because Faulkner had been a problem for the police because he interfered with the payoffs that the police were constantly getting from club owners who were allowed to stay open after hours by paying off the police.
Right, because we should note that the clubs are to close at 2 o'clock. And
this was 4
o'clock.
And
these were illegal after hour.
Which they did because they were paying off the cops, and the cops would go with it. And one of the interesting things about this is the timing of it, which is so important because it enables us to understand how they were framing and setting up Mumia Abu-Jamal. The timing is important because the cops go around at the closing time to these clubs in the after hours to get a take on how much was taken in by the clubs, because that's how they determine their cut for the night.
That's right.
They are paid on the basis of the receipt. receipts. So the cops are there to monitor this. Faulkner is brought there for this very purpose. Faulkner is thereby positioned to be set up. The brother of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is carrying the hitman in the car, is brought to the scene at the same time that Faulkner is there, so Freeman can get out of his car and shoot Faulkner. And Mumia, who does that round, the cops know perfectly well what the rounds are of the cabbies, and Mumia is there in that very district because when the clubs let out,
right,
he's there to pick up customers. So they bring it all. What I'm attempting to develop here, as you have done yourself in the massive accumulation of the evidence, is to show that we're not merely in the presence of the suborning of perjury. We're not merely in the presence of the terrorizing of witnesses. What we are in the presence of is the police conspiracy, the government conspiracy to take out Faulkner and to father this upon their intended victim, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Right.
That's the context. That's the significance. That's the meaning of this evidence of the terrorizing of witnesses and the actual pattern. One more quick point about Arnold Beverly.
Mm-hmm.
Before Arnold Beverly owned up to being the backup shooter, Arnold Beverly had already spoken out, and because of his own problems with the cops who had used and abused him, and said on the record, "I was there. Mumia Abu-Jamal did not shoot this cop."
Right.
Even before he acknowledged that he was one of the hitmen, he had already gone on record, and of course the police were in a tremendous quandary about this, and even more of a quandary for us. Is the extraordinary failure of the then counsel of Mumia Abu-Jamal, Leonard Weinglass and associates, to accept, act on, and mobilize around this extraordinary testimony by Arnold Beverly, there at the time, a cop killer, as it turns out, and a hired hand of the police and the authorities.
And isn't it true that Arnold Beverly took a lie detector test?
And passed it.
Yes, he passed two lie detector tests, one by, I can't remember the tester's name, but he was one of the most prominent lie detector experts.
Yeah.
Yeah, administrators in the country. And Beverly did say explicitly that he was hired by corrupt cops to do this hit. And according to Mumia's brother, William Cook, what Kenneth Freeman said, actually, let me back up a minute. Beverly said he and another guy, that's the exact quote. And by the way, Beverly's confession is available on videotape. It was never entered into the court because, as you pointed out, the legal team of Weinglass and Williams did a preemptive strike to make sure that it never got into court. The astounding thing is that defense lawyers for someone who's accused of murder, confronted with the confession of somebody else to that very same murder, did not bring it out. Of course, the only way to judge these things is to get something like that into court, and at which point the prosecution could cross-examine him. But they did not bring it out, and as a result, when it was brought forward into public by later lawyers for Mumia, it had lost its timeliness.
Yes, but Chris, look, in regard to the Beverly confession, Arnold Beverly was wearing a green khaki. Green khaki jacket. Kenneth Freeman, who is the passenger in Billy Cook's car, who has been identified by Singletary and others as the murderer of Faulkner, is also wearing a green khaki jacket.
Right.
The witnesses identify the killer of Faulkner as a heavy set figure wearing a green khaki jacket.
Right.
So it's not merely that the Beverly confession is a smoking gun, if you excuse the the image here, for the demonstration that Mumia is innocent, that he's framed, but the Beverly confession and and the information emerging from the Singletary's description of Kenneth Freeman establishes that all of the witness identifications are of the very people who have come forward to take responsibility, such as Beverly. They didn't just have a confession from Beverly. They had the very element that ties together the eyewitness testimony that exonerates Mumia Abu-Jamal, that indicts the police department. How could a legal team fail to trumpet this all over the world?
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Murdering Mumia, Part 2, The Anatomy of a Frame-Up. We are having a conversation with Chris Kinder. Chris.
Yes, I think we should back up just a little bit and give a little bit more background. As Ralph went into a little bit, there is a tremendous background of corruption on the part of the police in this case, and I'd just like to point out that there were federal investigations going on around the same time as this hit. And suits were brought by the federal government. I think Philadelphia is the only major city in the U.S. which was actually, the police department was actually prosecuted for corruption. And some 30 cops lost their jobs, including the head guy at the scene of the case against Mumia, that is at the scene of the Faulkner shooting. It was a guy named Alfonso Giordano, who later went to jail and actually did not even testify at the trial because he was so about to be convicted or had already been convicted of this corruption. So that's one of the background things you have to keep in mind, that what Beverly said, that is, that he was hired by corrupt cops to kill one of their own, is confirmed in that there was a background of precisely this kind of activity going on, and that's been well established. There's also indications that cops may have murdered some others of their own in other instances, so it's not entirely out of the question, as some people think, that the cops might kill one of their own. And if you remember the case of Frank Serpico, the famous cop in New York, about whom a movie was made, an attempt was made on his life, right, because he was testifying about corruption.
Chris, so, Don Hersing, the FBI agent, gave in his own affidavit the confirmation that Faulkner was cooperating,
right,
with the federal authorities against these corrupt cops. There's no ambiguity about the fact that Faulkner was a tremendous danger to them, and this murder was a cop operation.
And Faulkner herself noted that Daniel Faulkner was not supposed to work that night and that they were supposed to go to the movies. That's what they had planned to do. But he was not given the night off, and instead of putting on his uniform at the station, as he usually did, he put on his uniform at home and consequently wasn't wearing his bulletproof vest. That was in his locker room at the station.
Right. He was given the job of going down to check on, as Ralph was saying earlier, to check on the receipts from these clubs. So that's, I think, how he was set up. And Beverly says that he was told that Faulkner would be in the area to do just that. I don't think Hersing actually mentions Faulkner, but a Freedom of Information Act suit was brought and a file was discovered from the Justice Department about Faulkner, which is very long and was heavily redacted. So while it didn't actually say that Faulkner was talking to the FBI about this corruption, since he had that large file, it's an indication that he probably was. And this whole thing ties together that way and explains this, explains what really happened and why. And so that's why it's so astounding that most of the evidence here, it's not surprising, because the ruling class of this country, which depends on police like the corrupt Philadelphia police, does not want this stuff to come out for obvious reasons. Now, another background thing to keep in mind is that Mumia Abu-Jamal was a prominent journalist. He was an up-and-coming journalist, actually got awards for his journalism. He had been exposing the police, the brutal police attack on the MOVE organization in 1978, and for which people were falsely prosecuted who are now still in prison, the MOVE 9. And that's why Frank Rizzo, Mayor Frank Rizzo, threatened Mumia at a press conference, because Mumia had been raising bloody hell on the radio about this horrendous attack on the MOVE compound, in which one cop, a guy by the name of Ramp, had been killed by friendly fire.
By police fire.
Right. And so there's a very interesting connection here, working back around to what William Singletary said, the only, in my opinion, only really reliable witness. And furthermore, he's a extremely detailed witness in terms of his memory and his description of the events. And one of the most interesting things that he said was that when the cops came to the scene and they found Mumia there, they immediately picked him up and started beating him. And three on a side, they grabbed him and rammed his head into a pole, all the while shouting, "Ramp, ramp, ramp."
And this is after they
now,
had shot him.
Now, this is really interesting.
This is after he's dying. He's virtually
right.
dying on the ground.
Yeah, Mumia was shot on the scene. He was wounded.
His lungs were filled with blood. He could hardly speak. He was in danger of death, and they're ramming his head into a.
In some ways, it's amazing that he survived, but he did survive. But the point is that this guy, William Singletary, didn't know who Ramp was. And so he asked one of the cops, who's this guy Ramp that you're talking about? And one of the cops said right there that, oh, that was a cop who was killed in the line of duty in the raid on the Powelton village. And so, in other words, what this indicates is that the cops knew exactly who they had, and they were already victimizing Mumia and trying to kill him because Mumia had been a journalist who had exposed this outrage of this attack on the Powelton Village MOVE headquarters.
And that attempt to brutalize Mumia continued at the hospital,
yes,
as evidenced by journalist Lynn Washington and other reports of the staff at the hospital.
The cops went into his room and they stomped on his survival equipment, his oxygen equipment. They were trying to kill him on the spot.
That's right. And they also, as part of their fabrication of the evidence, fabricating evidence to frame Mumia, the police came up many weeks after the incident with a so-called confession where they said one cop attested to that Mumia had said, "Yeah, I killed the MF-er and I hope he dies." And we know that that's not possible because Mumia, as you pointed out, was extremely severely wounded and was incapable of shouting anything. They also came up with a hospital attendant to say the same thing, and a very suspicious typewritten piece of paper was brought into court affirming that from this hospital attendant that Mumia had made that confession. But the hospital attendant later confessed to a, I believe it was a relative of hers, that she hadn't actually heard Mumia say that at all, and that actually what Mumia said was, "Help get them off me, they're trying to kill me." And he apparently whispered that, she heard that's what she actually heard. So that's another indication of the intense frame of every single bit of evidence that brought in was manufactured. And furthermore, there's another interesting thing. You mentioned Lynn Washington a moment ago. Lynn Washington was a journalist and professor at Temple University. He heard about this incident that had happened at 6 a.m. when he woke up, and he heard about it on KYW News Radio show. And he went down there, and he testified that the crime scene was completely abandoned by that point. I think when he got down there, it was a little bit after, maybe 7 or 8 or something like that in the morning. And there was no taping off of the scene. There were no cops on the scene. Billy Cook's car was still sitting there, and he noticed a couple of drops of blood here and there. And, you know, this is a murder scene where a cop had just been killed and the cops aren't protecting the scene.
Well, this is
very
intended to destroy the evidence, the physical evidence.
They didn't care. They were making up all the evidence.
Mm.
They thought they, you know, they had the guy they wanted to pin it on. So what did they need with protecting the crime scene?
Well, that's what they did with the MOVE incident, too. They came in and they actually bulldozed the MOVE headquarters within hours after their firefight.
Well, let's look at this for one quick moment here, because what you're describing was orchestrated by the very man you mentioned earlier, namely Giordano. Giordano is on the scene. This is one of the very targets of Faulkner, and particularly of Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the most corrupt and one of the orchestrators of the corruption of the police department, who was ultimately indicted and I believe, jailed for this. Giordano is the figure on the scene. Now get this, brothers and sisters, the cop on the scene. There are no paraffin tests taken on Mumia Abu-Jamal.
That's right.
SOP, standard operating procedure, because when you fire a weapon or in the proximity of a weapon being fired, microscopic deposits of nitrates are placed in your pores, on your hand, on your face. It is impossible, if you fire a weapon or a weapon is fired near you, for nitrates not to be present in your hand and on your face. This was an important issue with respect to the Lee Harvey Oswald set up as the putative assassin of Kennedy, because the paraffin tests on Oswald demonstrates that he had not fired a weapon, nor is there any weapon near his face or his cheek. And in regard to Mumia Abu-Jamal, they took no paraffin test. They did nothing to establish issue. They would have done immediately if they were attempting to impute responsibility for this killing. And the obvious explanation is that they didn't do it because they wouldn't get the result that they needed. But Giordano is the author as well of the false, fake confession of Mumia. It is Giordano.
He was the first author of it, yes. He said that Mumia confessed as they were putting him into the van. But then he did, in fact, say this at pretrial hearings, okay? But he was never called because he was under indictment for this corruption.
And that's when they came forth with Priscilla Durham, the hospital security guard, who testified that she heard the wounded Jamal confess that he had shot the cop.
Right.
However, she then admitted that this was a lie, and she had told her stepbrother, Kenneth Pate, that what she had heard Mumia
right.
say was, quote, "Get off me, get off me, they're trying to kill me." And Kenneth Pate came forth in a declaration to state that. I think it's also important to talk about the trial of Mumia Abu-Jamal. His first lawyer, who had earned a reputation as an effective opponent of police brutality, and he was the director of the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia, and this was Jackson. William Jackson had no staff. He had become a single practitioner, was a single father, and had been threatened repeatedly during the time that he was the attorney. He had no funds. It was
He had no budget for investigations.
No budget, limited to $150 for ballistics experts that they wouldn't receive for 9, 10, and 12 months later. And so he couldn't even get any experts to come forward and investigate the material evidence of this case. And also significant, I thought, was that both Jackson and Mumia Abu-Jamal asked for Mumia to appear in a lineup. And this goes
right.
to the what you and Ralph had been talking about many of the witnesses, one having contradictory descriptions of who the shooter was, what he looked like, what he was wearing, and a conjoining of some of the witnesses in that they said the person was wearing a green camouflage army jacket, something that Mumia obviously was not wearing. And yet the judge, Sabo, refused Mumia's request and the request of his attorney, Jackson, for Mumia to appear in a lineup, something very
right.
obvious in police procedure. Could you please discuss the case?
I think we should mention that it's very sad news that one of Mumia's earlier lawyers that brought out this precise evidence and lots of other evidences that prove that Mumia was innocent, most of which has never appeared in court. Her name was Marlene Kamish. She died recently. And she's the one that told me, this is how I learned about it, that Mumia actually appeared in a pretrial hearing and demanding a lineup. And as Marlene Kamish put it, no guilty man willingly appears with the bright lights for an unknown and unseen person to identify him unless that he knows that he's innocent. And that's exactly what Mumia did, because he knew that no one could identify him as the shooter. And by the way, we should mention that Mumia was not wearing a green army jacket. William Singletary says that Kenneth Freeman, Singletary says shot the cop, was also wearing a long green army coat. So I think we should say a little bit more about what Singletary said and what the scenario that that really happened, because I gave a description of the scenario that the police invented, which, by the way, included Mumia standing over the fallen Faulkner, directly over him, and firing at his head. One of the things that the Polakoff photos confirmed, which was also, in fact, shown by earlier official police crime scene photos, and the Polakoff photos that I mentioned earlier confirmed it, and that is that there were no marks of bullet impacts on the sidewalk.
No divots.
The point where they're called divots, yeah, where, you know, that Faulkner had been lying. So that another lie is disproven. And William Singletary, interestingly, says that Faulkner was actually shot standing up, and that when he collapsed into a sitting position up against a building. And he wasn't, in fact, actually down on the ground at all when he was shot. And very interestingly,
there's a spread-eagled figure that is identified that corresponds to what Singletary is saying.
Spread-eagle against a building.
That's right.
Is what, but interestingly, that very same phrase was used in the KYW radio news report at the time, which journalist Lynn Washington heard at 6 a.m. and how he learned about what had happened. And they said the very same words, a man spread-eagled against a building. And so, and
by
that's
the way, Singletary identified Singletary, who knew helicopters, identified the helicopter.
KYW News helicopter.
Right, and they later tried to impugn his testimony.
Everybody said, "Oh, there's no
there were
such,
no cop
no
helicopters.
Police helicopters." Well, Singletary had never said they were police helicopters. And what gets me is that some people on the left who are defending Mumia to some extent fall for some of these lies. So that, for instance, a lot of people don't rely that much on what Singletary said, even though he had no reason to lie, making him pretty unique amongst the witnesses. And he was very clear about how he knew what he saw.
The photograph, the Pedro Polakoff photograph that you have been describing, corroborates Singletary in every respect, not only with regard to the divots, but with the positioning of the automobile in front of Faulkner's car. It corroborates him with all the particulars of what he observed. You have, as you say, Lynn Washington's description of the absence of the protection of the crime scene. But beyond that, the Polakoff photographs show the cops handling the weapons so that they're destroying any fingerprint evidence. And in particular, what weapon are we talking about here? A weapon that has grips too large for it, that is so dirty that it's
Faulkner's weapon.
Supposedly Faulkner's weapon. Here is a cop who we are being told has a weapon whose grips prevent it from being cocked properly, that is filled with dirt and grime, which would prevent it from being fired with any accuracy.
Which is uncharacteristic of Faulkner's reputation.
Well, this is not a police weapon. This is a classic throwdown weapon. What the cops carry to put down when they want to frame some black kid who is reaching for his handkerchief, and they put a weapon at his feet after they shoot him in cold blood.
Furthermore, one witness named Harkin said that Faulkner's weapon was still in its holster when they took Faulkner away to the hospital. So that's another interesting and And you mentioned that though residue tests were performed on Mumia's hands by the police after the shooting, they also did not perform any such tests on Faulkner's hands. And Beverly says that Mumia was shot by another cop arriving on the scene. So it's not the ballistics evidence here that you started to get into is another whole part of this case that's just completely cluttered up with lies and misrepresentations. There's a fragment of the bullet that went missing somehow from the police, and or the police said that it was missing, that is, and that might have given a better indication of exactly what the bullet was. And furthermore, William Singletary says that when Mumia did arrive at the scene, first of all, he arrived after the cop was shot. That's a very critical point in the timeline here, which some people on the in the defense aren't very clear about, and I can't understand why they do that. But Singletary was very clear that Mumia arrived after the cop was shot. Mumia himself and his own statement says exactly that. He says he heard gunshots while still in his cab, and only after that did he come across the did he notice his brother there and come across the street. And so anyway, Singletary affirms that the Mumia arrived unarmed. Okay, he arrived unarmed, and furthermore, Singletary says that he noticed in the Philadelphia papers a couple days after the incident an article that said that Mumia's gun had been found in the glove compartment of his taxi, which by that time was in police impound. Now, that article is nowhere to be found today, certainly not on the websites. And it's easy to understand with the corruption in Philadelphia police that the article might have been pulled from the early editions of the papers under police pressure, or perhaps taken and never put up on the websites or whatever. But it's very interesting and telling little thing, which if it were to be properly investigated, which I don't think it ever has, it would show, it would prove, or be another item on the mountain of evidence that shows that Mumia is innocent and never shot anybody.
Chris, in the closing minutes, let's discuss a campaign to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Where do we go from here?
Well, we should say right off the bat that Mumia has just been turned down by the Third Circuit Federal Court, what was probably his last, definitely his last federal appeal. He just lost that. They denied him a new trial. A three-judge panel rejected several major claims by Mumia's lawyers that the judge was prejudiced, and we know darn well that the judge, Albert Szabo, who was brought out of retirement to continue fixing the case by presiding over the 1995 PCRA hearings, that, you know, they say that that judge was not prejudiced. That is, the court said that. The court also ruled that Mumia was not deprived of due process of law, even though the prosecutor made serious errors. And the court threw out all of his claims. And demonstrations were just held around the world on April 19th to protest this fact. And I should also mention that there's an event in New York City coming up. We should just quickly mention, but what we need here is a mass movement to free Mumia. It's impossible for Mumia and this corrupt, rigged system to get a fair trial. His legal remedies are almost exhausted, and it was impossible anyway in this rigged system to get a fair trial. And so what we need is a mass movement such as what was built in 1995 that helped at that time save Mumia's life.
Chris, when we confronted the Justice Department and the Deputy's Attorney General, there was an exchange with the head of the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. We had presented him this evidence of perjured testimony. We had presented him with the evidence of fabricated data and of the framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal. documented with chapter and verse, and he said as follows. Al Moskowitz, head of the criminal section. We can investigate as a criminal matter the use of excessive force by the police officers and by police departments. We can bring criminal charges against the violation of the bodily integrity of citizens occurring at the hands of the police. But I have to tell you that we are constrained by a 5-year statute of limitations, specific circumstances which just allow us to maintain jurisdiction even if the limitation period is run, and our mandate will enable us to act if there is evidence of a continuing conspiracy. I responded with this. I wish to stress that Mumia Abu-Jamal was brutalized, tormented, and tortured by the police of Philadelphia. This defines the case. It is a hallmark of the other documented violations of his rights presented to you. It embodies a breach of the letter and spirit of rights which generations have struggled to secure. This is why this case compels you to act. This pattern of abuse continues to this day in the treatment of evidence, the intimidation of witnesses, the suborning of perjury, which we have documented here, and when exposed, witnesses subjected to police terror. These are the ongoing facts. They are not nullified by a statute because they apply in each jurisdiction of judicial review, and wherever it occurs, we take note of what you have told us regarding your statutory mandate, and we demand that you act in this case, consistent with that mandate, and bring justice to bear for those to whom it is systematically denied. The Justice Department never came back to us. They had promised to give separate answers, as Stuart Ishimaro, Deputy Attorney General, said, to every question you pose regarding every document you have submitted. And it never happened, brothers and sisters. They are complicit. The injustice goes to the very top. It comes down to the police department, from the Justice Department, from the Attorney General, from the ruling class in this country. That's the reality. It requires a class struggle to free this man and to free all the victims of class oppression in the United States.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, part two of Murdering Mumia, the frame-up, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Part one, a strategic component of the war on Black America, is also there. Please attend the event for Mumia Abu-Jamal, Wednesday, April 23rd, Byrd, The Life and Tragic Death of James Byrd, Jr., with Dick Gregory, Martin Luther King, Jr., the Third, and Jesse Jackson and others, a House of the Lord Church on Atlantic Avenue. And call 212-330-8029 for more information. Check www.freemumia.com. We will be with you next week with a conversation with Lynn Stewart on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, her case, and other cases such as that of Leonard Peltier.